This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 16th of July, 2010. And today I am joined on the line once again for my monthly conversation by the man, the myth, and the legend behind the international forecaster, Bob Chapman at InfoForecaster.com. Bob Chapman, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. It's a joy to be here. I love your program, and I can't get enough of it.
Well, excellent. It's good to hear that, and my listeners can't get enough of you from the feedback that I'm getting, so it's great to have you back on, as always. And I guess there's a number of things that we could be talking about today. There's so much going on in the world, but why don't we start with a little bit of an update of the European crisis as it continues to unfold, and as we heard yesterday from Daniel Estulin about some of the aspects of what's happening behind the scenes in Europe. What can you tell us about what's unfolding in the financial world over there?
Well, I see that in Italy, Berlusconi is demanding changes in salaries and wages and retirement dates and amounts and austerity. And he's getting a lot of flack from the communists and others. But I think probably due to the circumstances, that sort of thing will be voted in. Spain's doing the same thing. Spain's numbers are just horrible. I mean, they owe so much money per capita, it's mind-boggling. Not as bad as Greece, but they're a much bigger country, too. No one has purchased any bonds from Spain in 2 months, except for the European Central Bank. No one will buy them. And I think one of the things about Germans, and I lived a long time in Germany, I speak a few of their dialects as well, and I think the Germans have got the grasp on the thing. They've been worked around, messed around with since the Second World War because they were the bad guys, and I think this is the final for them. I think in their mind's eye they've been sacrificed enough. The continual occupation of troops in their country, the terrible price they had to pay to join Eastern and Western Germany financially was dreadful. And finally now it'll probably take another 20 or 30 or 40 years to bring Eastern Germany up to a level with Western Germany, particularly in the way they think, because having lived under communism for a long time. But what they've said is that, you know, we're really not interested in giving these people money to continue to do what they're doing, even if they have austerity. These people are a bunch of losers as far as the Germans are concerned. They don't want to conserve. They don't want to save. They really don't want to work. They're not serious about life. They want to have a lot of fun while they're here. And the German attitude is much different, much more austere. And I think students of history are very well aware of that. And so what they're talking about is, let's write it off. Well, this is very interesting. This is what I predicted, incidentally. And I think they got the right idea. Let's let them write off two-thirds, them being the five nations in trouble. I hate calling them pigs. I think it's a very derogatory phrase. I mean, they made a lot of mistakes, but they don't need to be called that. I've never said that on a program before, but it turns me off. Anyway, those that are in trouble, look, all the debt that you owe to us, you owe us one-third now. You can pay that off, and we'll write the other. You can default on the remainder, and you make your choice. Do you want to stay in the euro, don't you? You know that you've not been able to compete because you haven't been able to increase productivity, man hours, and you just keep on falling behind, and you should really consider using your own currencies. And when you do that, the currencies will be worth less than the equivalent of what the euro was, and your exports are going to be cheaper, and so that would give you an advantage, but your imports are going to be more expensive. And so you're going to have to deal with particularly petroleum imports. And I think that the individual nations will probably pull away. I see a trend in Europe towards decentralization. They've had enough of central planning from Brussels and Frankfurt, whether it be through the European Central Bank or through the European Union. I mean, the bureaucrats in the European Union treat everybody else within the Union that isn't on their level like a bunch of peasants. And that's not really what it's all about. All they want to do is be governed and not be looked down upon. And so with that said, I think that there's an excellent possibility over the next year, year and a half, that the euro could cease to be. And I think if that happens, I think it could be because of world depression, because I think we're going to get it no matter which way they cut it. I think what could happen is a breakup of the European Union. And I think the key to that would be the ending of WTO. And I think that could come about by England saying, look, you know, we're not making any headway, and we don't use the euro, as you well know. I don't see any advantage any longer of belonging to the European Union, and you are on the continent or not. So we're going to leave WTO because we have to put tariffs on, otherwise we can't survive. And the minute they do it, the U.S. will follow, and then the whole world will follow. And it's probably the best thing that ever happened to us because it would kick NAFTA and CAFTA and any other treaties like that right out the window. And it would disarm to an extent the workings of the internationalists for world government, because that interconnectivity is what they were trying to impose, and obviously it hasn't worked. And so I see Europe heading in that direction with England and the United States following. And, you know, there's a dichotomy of interest here, which is very unusual. And that is that England and U.S. usually do things together. England does them first, and the U.S. follows 6 months to a year later. That's not happening at the moment. England has gone into austerity. At least at this time, they are trying to keep their inflation down by not creating too much money in credit. I think it was inflation is like 3.3%. The new figure that we had this week in the International Forecaster. And so in the United States, the figures are different. There's no austerity yet. And the inflation rate that they admit to is somewhere about 1.5% to 2%, which is not reality. But none of the figures are reality when they're put out by government. And so there is a change there. And I'll end this by saying you don't have austerity and increased taxes unless you really want a depression. What they all should be doing if they want to do that is have austerity. That's okay. But cut taxes. Because if you do that, the oil that keeps the purchasing within society continues to go, and then it gives you an opportunity to work yourself out of some of the problems that you have.
Right. Exactly. Well, if austerity meant just cutting the size of government and getting government out of people's business, that would be a great thing. But unfortunately, austerity in this case tends to mean increased government and decreased government programs, just more interference and taxation, which, yeah, absolutely, is a good formula for depression. And listening to you talk about the idea of all of these giant centralized control bodies falling apart like the EU or the WTO, I have to pinch myself to make sure I'm not dreaming, because obviously that would be such a wonderful thing for people who are concerned about the erosion of national sovereignty. But I can't help but imagine that somehow this crisis is going to be used for centralization of control, as almost every crisis imaginable always is used towards that aim. And just to play the devil's advocate, here in Japan, I saw this coming across the news wires today from the AP here in Tokyo. Debt crisis will strengthen Europe, French PM says. And I'll just read a little bit of this. France's prime minister said Friday that Europe is united in tackling the Greek debt crisis and will emerge stronger than ever as he sought to calm the fears of an important Asian trading partner. Speaking to business leaders in Tokyo, François Fillon reassured investors that the European Union and its common currency are not in peril, as critics have charged. And it goes on and on. But basically, yes, this sounds like a sort of a marketing campaign for the euro for someone who's just desperately trying to drum up support from Japanese investors who are, I suppose, probably looking quite warily at the entire European enterprise, and with good reason. But there are at least some out there who are still trumpeting the European Union trumpets out there.
Well, that's to be expected. But I think behind the scenes, we've got them on the run. The exposures that have come by Danny Esslin and Jim Tucker perennially at the Bilderberger meetings, the push towards the carbon taxation. Two parts to this from my viewpoint. I think what BP did was a false flag operation, and those who want to disagree with me, that's fine. And the reason for it was a passage of some sort of a cap and trade agreement so the very wealthy can trade these credits and put the boot to the public. Second of all, and more important, is that carbon tax. And I think by temporary or maybe permanently capping this so-called problem in the Gulf of Mexico, it signals to me, because they could have let this thing go on indefinitely, it signals to me that they have, number one, settled for a skeleton cap and trade, hoping they can pass it. They've given up on carbon taxes for the moment. And I don't know when they'll ever get another opportunity. The reason I say that, I think there's going to be enormous changes at the November election, and it's going to get worse for them because all the people they get bought and paid for politically are going to be out of office, a lot of them. And so with that said, the reason they want carbon taxes so badly is that they can in part put the burden of debt not only in the United States but throughout the world, because I would assume if the U.S. were to accept it, put in place a carbon tax, everybody else would do it. Or not everybody else, but a lot of countries would. I would think that not only would defray the debt through the hard work of the average person, but as importantly, the Illuminist idea is because the dollar has been so vilely corrupted, there's no better way to say it, they want to replace it. And they're talking the special drawing rights, the SDRs at the IMF, which was such a disaster during the late 60s. I was there, I know. And they want to put them in place. And if you look at the IMF rules, it says you can't have gold backing on your currency, so that includes the SDR as well. And any currency that's used without backing, whether it's commodities, it's got to be something. Gold and silver are the easiest. And any currency without backing is not going to work. And so with that said, they at the IMF, they who do the planning for the IMF, wanted these carbon taxes so there would be a cash flow coming in to back up the SDR. And their plan is, and I think they will continue to pursue it, their plan is that the SDR would be set at a certain level, and all currencies would be weighted against that, and so they'd be either revalued or devalued. And then would come what we discussed earlier in regard to the euro and the debt outstanding by the five laggards, we'll call them. The part of it would be, and they'd have a large meeting to do this, Part of it would be the default on debt. And it looks like they're shooting for, you know, one-third payback and the other two-thirds defaulted, just like Argentina did. And I thought at the time, between 99 and 2001, that that was a trial. And I wrote about it at the time. I said, they're going to use this again, and that's why this is being done. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, that's where I think everything is headed. But without the carbon tax, there's nothing to back the SDR. So I don't know what they're going to do. But they're in deep trouble, that's for sure.
Right. That's an excellent, excellent point. And you are absolutely right, I think, in your assessment that they have lost whatever... Actually, I mean, they did have such incredible momentum for a carbon tax, and it seemed almost like it was going to be an inevitable reality even just a short year and a half ago. But just now, it seems... absolutely unattainable to them. And I certainly hope it remains that way, and that no false flag incident in the Gulf or anything else will help to change that or sway that. And it certainly seems that in November things are going to be changing, just in tectonic shift that's coming along, and seems almost unstoppable. And that's exactly why we see this increase in rhetoric about a 9/11 or an OKC is the only thing that can save Obama now. We have top Clinton officials saying that now on the record. So all I can say is brace yourself for whatever that might be coming. And we have to be on guard, I guess, for false flag incidents, which, of course, is still the best way to corral the sheep into another pen and to, you know, make sure that they stay in line. But what do you see coming in terms of any October surprise or anything that you think might be on the way?
Gee, that's hard to contemplate. You know, we've had a big surprise. At first there was North Korea, and then there was the bomber in Times Square. And then we've had the BP incident, and I could go into detail to show you why I think the way I do in relation to that. But I'm pretty concerned about the situation, and I think I know why it happened, and that was to get those two pieces of legislation passed, which I think they're going to be unsuccessful at. And one of the reasons why is programs like this, we keep on telling people the truth, and that's highly explosive to them. I mean, these people are running in all different directions at the same time, and you listen to what Brzezinski and Kissinger say, and these are guiding lights of this internationalist movement. They're saying, look, they're telling everybody what we're doing. Not much come out of the Bilderberger meeting. Why? Because everybody already knows it. And we've exposed them. And that's why I do as many programs as I do. And because I get great joy out of seeing these people squirm. And, you know, one of the things to track back about the decentralization in Europe and the possible end to the EU and WTO and other regional treaties like that is that these illuminists can use this as a cover and say, well, gee, this happened and that happened. It wasn't our fault. Just like wars are acted for cover, act as cover as well. And I think they're trying to extricate themselves, and they want a way out in case they lose the battle.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about that. Go into some more detail.
Well, it's an exercise in psychological warfare. We know, at least those listening to this program are well aware, that there are people behind government who have these different organizations, which we've named in the past, that believe in world government. And they've done some very dastardly things to bring it about, like the collapse of the entire financial system. And they've done this before. This is nothing new. Now, if they can't control this thing, and right now they can't control it, if they can't, in the final analysis, control it, they will try to use something to deflect responsibility so that there's not trials and people fined or put in jail or hung or whatever. And decentralization would be one of the ways to do that, just like a war would be. Because you can blame it on somebody or something else.
Right, so you're saying it's a tactic that they might use to avoid accountability when the reckoning comes.
Yes, exactly. And I think they're preparing for that. I think they're scared to death. And they should be. I mean, they've done some horrible things. I mean, look at yesterday. The Securities Exchange Commission says to Goldman Sachs, you are wrong, you committed fraud, and we're fining you $550 million. They stole $5 billion. Crime pays in America. I mean, 4 months ago, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's firm, was charged with cheating the government, defrauding the government of $300 million. They paid a $100 million fine and kept $200 million. You go back to the late 80s, Michael Milken stole $3 billion, and he went to jail for it. He paid the government $1 billion and kept $2 billion. I mean, what kind of incentive is there for young people in our society not to be a criminal?
Exactly. But not to be any kind of criminal, you have to be a criminal that steals a lot of money. The more you can steal, the better it'll be.
That's true.
So don't set your sights too low.
That's absolutely correct.
Yes, unfortunately, very true. Well, yes, I was going to get into that. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about the SEC settlement with Goldman Sachs?
Well, I don't know the lurid details, but overall, it was a big win for these crooks. And it was a slap in the hand. This is chump change to these people. It's one day's trading. I mean, is there anybody who's looking and listening? Do they understand the import of Goldman being practically not even punished? I mean, money means nothing to these people. They got so much of it. I mean, the people who run the company are multimillionaires. It's just like the people who run the different organizations, including the Illuminis. They're worth billions. What are you going to do, fine them $1 billion and they keep the other $20 billion? People don't get it. It's a sideshow. Let's go steal, and if we get caught, we pay a fine. You know what they call it on Wall Street? And I was there for 28 years. I own my own firm. They call it an occupational hazard. That's how they treat it.
Exactly. Right. Well, okay, let's shift gears a little bit. We often talk about the European crisis, and we often talk about the American economy, but I'd like to try to touch on some of the other areas of the globe that we don't often talk about. For example, the Canadian housing bubble that Daniel Estulin was saying yesterday might be about to burst, and the Chinese housing bubble, that also real estate bubble that's bursting, and anything in South America. What do you see as some potential hotspots or interesting places elsewhere around the globe right now?
Well, first of all, you got to look at the communist countries in South America. The newest edition, Uruguay, and the man that runs that place, this guy's a hardcore killer. Then you've got Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and you have a very, very socialist government in Brazil. And, you know, Brazil's booming, and they're paying 12.5%. The government is 12.5% to borrow money. I mean, how can that be normal? And so I think they've got problems that they don't really know about yet. And Argentina's a mess, the only really well-run country in South America is Chile, and unfortunately they had an earthquake, and that's going to set them back on their heels for probably 5 or 10 years. And but they've done very well. In Central America, some real problems in Guatemala and in Nicaragua. Honduras is doing okay. Costa Rica is doing okay. They're protected by all those ships and marines offshore, I guess. And I'm sure they're having a great time. They probably get on the bus in Punta Arenas and take it up to San Jose to see the city, so to speak. I used to live there. And then Mexico is doing quite well. The economy was off a bit, but they're doing very well. You wouldn't even know there was any kind of a recession in Mexico. And so that's generally Latin America. housing, people pay cash. So they don't have the problems they have in other places. It used to be in Canada, people paid cash too, but they don't anymore. And they usually have short-term loans of 5 years. But they're still borrowing. And I've written about, in fact, tomorrow's issue, I have a piece for one of the Canadian newspapers about the housing situation. And yes, in Ontario, particularly BC, prices are going to be coming down. They just can't stay at the levels that they're at. In Alberta, there's probably more downside as well. The Maritime provinces never went up, and they're not going to come down. They've been, I guess they've been in the Depression for the last 100 years. And the people who didn't like it moved over to Quebec or Ontario, or they floated down to Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. You know, when I was a kid, I used to work with a lot of what they used to call puddle jumpers and herring chokers in Boston. And they had all come down from the Maritime provinces. But anyway, you know, most of those countries are doing relatively well compared to the United States. And I think that will continue. There'll be exceptions. Basically because they haven't really, as a group, overextended, and they do pay cash for their homes. Maybe 2% of people borrow money to purchase homes. And that's understandable, you know, the rates are 11 to 12%. And that's double what they are in the United States. The bubble in real estate in China certainly exists. They poured $2.1 trillion in about 13, 14 months into the economy. They wanted to get production up and expansion and hire people, and it didn't happen. The people took the money and they poured it into the stock market, which since last October is down 23 or 24%, and they went into the real estate market, which is way, way overpriced, and it's a bubble, and it's going to correct. I don't know whether Canada's a bubble, but it's going to correct. And Japan housing prices have been going down since 1992. They've been in a depression since then, and they haven't come out yet.
Well, Japan in general has been in the doldrums for the last 20 years, and is, I guess, an example of the best possible case scenario we could be looking at in the long term globally, but I don't think it's going to play out that way. All right. Again, extremely interesting. And you mentioned that you're going to be having the next issue of the newsletter coming out tomorrow. Why don't you tell people a little bit more about the International Forecaster?
Well, the forecast is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. We publish on Wednesday and Saturdays via email. Runs around 40 or so pages each time. And we have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet. That goes out twice a month. And you can get a free introductory copy by going to our site. It's a new one, www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. The email is bob@intforecaster.com. And I give you that because you can get a free copy there, but you can also ask questions, and we answer everybody, and that's for sure. And we answer them promptly, incidentally. And then those of you who would like to call toll-free, we have a number, and that is 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. And there's a special offer there. And if you'd like to take advantage of it, you can get a free subscription for a year to the International Forecaster. And I'd like to say that all the news that you need to know each week that's important to you in your life and your investments is in the Forecaster.
Bob Chapman, if this is what you look like in retirement, I shudder to think what you looked like when you were actually working.
Well, I get a little heavier, but
a little older. But do you ever sleep? I mean, you are a very prolific man.
Well, last night I went to sleep at 9. I get up at 4. I wrote from 4 to 6. Judy joined me. We went on the computer. In between, I do a little writing. Today was a relatively easy day on the computer, so we could probably wrap up everything by 1 o'clock in anticipation of publishing late tonight and being ready to be on with Alex Jones, which I'm on with every Friday. And I never know what Alex is going to talk about, so you can't prepare for it. You've got to be very fast on your feet with this fellow, because he moves from one subject to the other, and he's brilliant. He's got a good show and a great show, and I enjoy doing it. I enjoy them all for different reasons, but it's a heavy day. Today I'm only going to be on 4 hours on the radio. Yesterday I was on 7. I do 25 or 30 hours a week. New people call me all the time, and I don't refuse anybody. I go on and talk, and if they want me back, it's terrific. If they don't, that's okay.
Well, that's awesome, and that is a shining example of the way that the work ethic that we need in order to win this fight. So absolutely, my hat's off to you for all of the work that you're doing, and I certainly hope people will check out InForecaster.com and check out the absolutely invaluable newsletter. And next edition will be coming out tomorrow, and I'll be looking forward to it. So, Bob Chapman, thank you so much, as always, for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for listening, and I'll see you again soon.